we take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol, a special, special episode of Fusion Patrol, because I am joined tonight by the two gay geeks from the TG Geeks podcast, one of whom I think you already know. That's Ben. Good evening, Ben.
Hi there.
And the other one is Keith, who has never been on this podcast before. Hello, Keith.
Hey, howdy, hey.
And it is a special day here on Fusion Patrol because we are looking at the debut episode of Peter Capaldi as the Doctor in the episode Deep Breath. And I just wanted to say before we get into the usual podcast that I personally have been looking forward to this for a very long time, about since the moment they announced who he was.
And why is that?
Well, because I am an older Doctor fan. And it tells you something, it's getting increasingly hard for a Doctor to be older than me. Every year it seems to get harder and harder. And, you know, my Doctor was Pertwee, Tom Baker. Those are the days I remember. Those are the types of authoritative, action-oriented, eccentric Doctors. And Peter Capaldi is obviously a man who knows his Doctor Who. I think his first premiere, he stepped out and he twiddled his thumbs like the first Doctor. So he's clearly, and I think we all know, he's very much the geek. So I have been very much looking forward to this. And so much so that I will say that when they leaked out the scripts online, I went and got them and I read them.
For shame.
I'm not one of those people that spoilers bothers. I mean, I read practically the target novelizations of most of Doctor Who long before I ever saw the episodes, and it never bothered me in the slightest. So to me, what it did do, though, is it gave me an interesting opportunity to know what was on the page before they made the episode. And there's a couple of things I want to mention when we get into the podcast. So are you guys looking forward to Peter Capaldi? I'm always going to call him that, too. There's something about the way he pronounces that last Capaldi.
Which is correct. It's not Capaldi. It's Capaldi.
It's Capaldi. I know. But something about it makes me want to turn him into, like, somebody that should be in a circus. It's Peter Capaldi and the amazing knife throwing act or something. It just does that. I'm going to try to break that. Anyway, what were you guys thinking before this episode came, one way or the other?
Well, I think that for me, this was the first premiere where I was actually rather positive, feeling optimistic. I had a certain excitedness towards it in the past with Doctor Who specials and whatnot. I've always kind of gone into them feeling a little, a little worried, a little negative almost, but not this time. I was actually very excited about this new premiere, and that's largely due to the fact that it was Peter Capaldi.
Keith?
I was very much looking forward to it as well. I thought, it's time we get back to an older Doctor.
I'm just wondering, we'll get to it, I guess, in the main part, but did we set ourselves up for failure by looking forward to it instead of not?
That's a tricky one to answer right now.
So, synopsis in the short kind, because we are not going to be very spoilery, and I'm sure everyone's just watched the episode. In Victorian London, the veiled detective, Madame Vastra, and her sidekicks, Jenny and Strax, encounter a massive dinosaur down by the Thames. How did it get there? Answer, it traveled on the outside of the TARDIS, which it swallowed in the Jurassic. The newly regenerated Doctor is quickly embroiled in a murder mystery involving spontaneous human combustion and clockwork robots that have been keeping themselves alive by stealing human parts. Can Clara find the Doctor she knows before time runs out, or is he forever a stranger to her?
That's it?
I told you.
Wow.
Very short. Yeah.
Man, that was brief.
That was brief. First thoughts. Keith?
I didn't know. The first watch, I wasn't sure what to think of the episode. It just left me kind of like, huh? And then on the second watch, a lot of things became more clear. I did like the episode after watching it the second time. The first time I thought, oh, it was a little weird at the beginning, and then lost me in the middle. And then when it wound up, I had warmed up to the Doctor and warmed up to the episode. Hmm. But the second time around, it really made more sense.
Okay. Keith? The other Keith, Ben.
Yes. I enjoyed it quite a bit. At first watch, there were a couple of moments where I like Keith, I found myself scratching my head thinking, do I really want it to go in this direction? But as it went on, I really found myself getting lost in a good way in some of its heart and some of the messages that this episode was actually conveying. And there was some good messages being telegraphed here. So by the time it was over, I was enormously satisfied and rather pleased with what I'd seen.
I enjoyed it. When I read the script, I loved it.
Yes,
I went from loving it to, yeah, I like it.
Uh-huh. I was afraid that would happen.
And I can give you a couple of examples of things that I liked in the script. And it could just be me, because I only read it once.
Well, let me ask you this. Mm-hmm? How much did the script differ from what you saw?
I would say, assuming that we can allow for slight memory problems, like there was an occasional line here and there that I don't recall, but that could just be, you're reading, you don't necessarily, I didn't memorize it. It was pretty much line for line. And of course, if I understand correctly, those were dubbing scripts, so they should be line for line exactly right. There's a couple things that when I read it came off differently. One, the minor one I did think, I was like, how are they going to do that? My impression reading the script was that Jenny was naked when she was painting, or not painting, when Vaster was painting. And I thought, she's just wearing a shawl. And it's like, how are they going to do that and justify it? I mean, it was bad enough when Matt Smith was naked in Time of the Doctor. And I thought, that's pushing it a little bit. So the fact that she was really basically dressed, it may have been Victorian underwear, but Victorian underwear is bigger and more clothing than much modern outerwear is now. So, that was one. And of course, then when Clara comes in and she says, just plop your clothes down on the chair, well, that means a lot more when Jenny is completely naked,
unless it's all the outer wear.
And maybe they didn't rework the script. Maybe they had intended for Jenny to be,
and they just decided to change it.
And then,
right. Which is, how you translate from script to a thing. But the thing that really got me that was different was I felt in the script that the Doctor was a lot more action oriented in the script. A couple of examples. Well, the main example is diving off the bridge and swimming after the murderer. In the script, it comes off like Action Man leaps off and dives, and I'm picturing a beautiful dive into the water, head first, hands form, and then a strong swim off into the Thames.
Instead, he just
kind of steps off of it and goes flunk, and then we don't even see him swimming. Water.
He just disappears. You hear a splash of water, and that's it.
I like it in my head better.
Most people do that way. Yeah. I mean, theater of the mind tends to be preferable.
It is a difference, and to the active nature of the Doctor, I really was getting a strong Pertwee off the script. I could have read that whole script in Pertwee's voice and mannerisms all the way through, with a little bit of Colin Baker thrown in there. But for the most part, it was like, wow, it's John Pertwee's back. And I don't necessarily want somebody aping John Pertwee, but, there were qualities in John Pertwee, there were qualities in Tom Baker that were the same as the qualities in John Pertwee, that, manifest themselves as a Doctor. More commanding, more acerbic, more action-oriented when it needs to be. So, for the young guys, Tennant and Smith, even though they were young and fit and able, they weren't very dynamic, apart from running up and down a corridor. So those were the things that caught my mind. It's like it's less than the script, and I don't think that's a good thing. So, but I did still enjoy it, and I'm not
you were
at
disappointed,
all,
though.
I'm not at all diminished in my liking of what Peter Capaldi, got to do the voice right, is bringing to it. I do wonder how much of it he was bringing to it that he was doing regenerative stuff. Because, for example, on my second viewing, I noticed he was kind of doing a Matt Smith there at times.
A little like bit by with the Thames, waving of the arms.
Waving of the arms and a lot of the lines of dialogue like, is it a broom? It's replaced. No, it's not a broom. But you can still sweep with it. No, strike that. I mean, that's classic Matt Smith stumbling across a sentence until he realizes he's spoken too much and then cuts back. So right. That could
I
just
found
be the...
some of that a little distracting. The regeneration episodes are always for me kind of odd because they stumble around, but this one was really distracting.
Well,
but I was a little distracted from the very beginning by a couple of things that kind of threw me off. So that made the whole watching the first time a little odd. So
I do want to add that, and you know, we've all three of us have watched the Doctor Who Extra that was available on the BBC iPlayer. Now there is a little bit there where you see a Grand Moff. He's watching the filming of the episode. Now he already had this script written.
Mm-hmm.
So he had all the voices in his head figured out as best as he could. He only can get so much out of Peter Capaldi up to a point. I mean, he never worked with him because Moff did not write Fires of Pompeii, if I'm correct.
I don't believe so, no.
No. So this is really the first time that he's had a chance to work with him. You know, I'm not going to count the Christmas special because that was just too brief. So to actually watch Peter Capaldi in work, this was the first time with the filming of this episode. And Moffat makes the comment that he watched him and was getting a sense of the beats that Peter likes to use when he is delivering his lines.
Uh-huh.
And I figure that what we're going to see is it's not just a case of Peter Capaldi kind of growing into the role, but perhaps also the writers, Moffat included.
That's not good because that's what ruined Matt Smith. If you go back and look at Matt Smith's first few episodes, he was great. I mean, I really liked Matt Smith. And then when Moff figured out what great comic timing he had, suddenly he got worse and worse and worse the more fantastic comic timing they put in there. And so I was actually, when I saw that scene on Doctor Who X, I was actually worried because he was looking at the scene where he was aping Matt Smith, in my opinion. He's like, oh, I was watching his timing and his beats, and I'm like, oh, no, he's doing Matt Smith right now. Don't watch that. Watch something else. Go somewhere else. Don't look at that.
Well, that's all we saw. We have no idea what Moffat all saw. And the only reason he was watching that is because that was Peter's first... I mean, it's the first time we actually see the Doctor in the episode, and as it turns out, it was the first scene filmed.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah,
because that's it is relatively kind of uncommon. Yeah,
it is rather unusual, and I wonder if that was by design.
I understand the argument that says don't throw the actor into his first role when he's doing the regeneration thing, but I think you know what better time for you to be finding your feet than when nobody will know whether you've found your feet or not.
Exactly.
So, you know,
I think that sometimes
you can stumble around and find yourself through that whole episode.
Well, I think that's why in the past, usually regeneration episodes, at least with Classic Who, regeneration episodes were seldom the first episodes filmed.
I would say it's actually probably a little bit less than half were filmed that way. It's towards the later years that they did it, but Troughton and Pertwee and Baker all filmed their episodes first.
No, okay.
And then Davison didn't. That's
no,
the cast.
I know that.
But then Colin Baker did because of that silly put one episode a year before the others.
Oh, God, I forgot about that.
Sylvester McCoy had no choice.
That's true.
And then, of course, Eccleston may or may not have. I don't know.
No idea.
Tennant did because it's the Christmas special.
That's true.
And so then they went back
so
to it for Matt Smith.
So actually, it was... It sounds like it might have been only one Doctor then.
Davison and Smith, for sure. And then maybe Eccleston.
Maybe.
Because I don't know where they... I don't remember when they started.
But in terms of Classic Who, I guess it looks Davison. Like it was only Peter Davison, which I'm rather surprised by. Anyway.
But... So I'm fine with them doing that.
Well, you make a good point, but I kind of have to... Well, I'm going to hope that Moffat is going to look more towards Peter's acting strengths and go in
those
that
eyebrows.
Direction. His eyebrows that can pop bottle caps. instead of, and those eyebrows are killer, let's be honest. Man, those things
are mighty eyebrows.
They are prehensile. Let's be honest.
That's why they will have their own country.
That's yeah, land of eyebrows. I would like to hope that, I mean, we're judging it based on this one intro scene, and if Moffat is the Doctor Who fan he claims he is, he will also understand that this is post-regenerative madness that is happening story-wise. So with any luck, he will realize, okay, you know, the real strengths of Peter Capaldi are going to come much later in the episode. Let me look at those and go in that direction. You know, Matt Smith is kind of a hard case because Matt Smith is a loon to begin with. I mean, he's a wild loon. Mm. You know, Peter Capaldi's he's different. He's more he's far more focused in his lunacy.
He's a little older.
A little older, and he does it with a bit more gravitas. But I say, you know, and usually I'll be the first one to condemn Moffat on everything. I have done that numerous times in the past, but this is the one time I'm actually going to give him the benefit of the doubt and say, I think he knows what he's doing, and I think he's going to approach Peter's character development in the right way and not exploit the goofy stuff that we saw earlier on, but more try to build on the doctor that we saw at the end of the episode.
Yeah, I hope so. I've got a series of notes of is talking points to bring out. So I'm going to kind of hit.
So does Keith.
Well, oh, good. Let me ask you a question right off the bat.
Uh-oh, I know where I know where this is going.
All right. Go ahead.
What about?
Here it comes.
And I suppose that you have this already on your list. I haven't seen your list.
I haven't seen my list. Well, the first thing on my list, if you hit the first thing on my list, I'll be mighty impressed.
Oh, shit.
The line where Vastra says, oh, I remember them when I was a child. And then, so it made me say Silurian period with a T-Rex. Excuse me? We're only 400 million years difference there.
Well, we know that the Silurians, well, we've had that. The Silurians,
yeah.
No. They're definitely
not from the Silurian period. Let's be honest.
And then when Pertwee corrected himself in the Sea Devils, he was still wrong. So, you know, I don't think they've mentioned Silurians at all in the new series. They call them Homo Reptilia. So we're just going to put them as Jurassic. And
weren't they actually addressed as Silurians in the episode where they kind of came back?
I think he did mention that they were called that, but it's the wrong name. It's one of those. It's kind of like Kirk.
Yeah, there was
a really weird
hand wave done on his part.
Homo Reptilia.
Yeah, it was something very strange.
Yeah.
But she is referred to as a Silurian. If you go to any of the websites or you look at the TARDIS wiki, she is referred to as a Silurian.
That's just a misnomer. It's never going to get... never going to be right. But that was not the first thing I wanted to mention.
Oh, my God.
There is one thing in this episode that I detested beyond belief.
Magic wand?
No. It's the part where you take a rat, live rat, and you stick an electrode up its butt. And then you turn the power on, and the rat screams. And then you pass that through an auto-tune device, and you get the new Doctor Who theme song.
Oh, Keith hated it.
Awful.
Yeah, Keith hated it.
I hated it.
My note was that I found it tinny.
I liked the clocky graphics intro. I loved that.
I love the visuals.
But I was not fond of the music.
No, the music is. I found the music to be okay, but it was awfully tinny. But to be honest. That was the first thing Keith noticed.
It's an auto-tuned rat. It's got to be an auto-tuned rat.
That was one of the first things because they really redid the way it structured the beats of the whole intro music, and it threw me off right from the very beginning. And then the whole T-Rex thing, and there were a couple of things that just threw me right off that caused me the first time through to be distracted and not pay attention.
I think perhaps, and I hate to say this because I think some of his strongest work came during the Matt Smith era, but I think Murray Gold may have gone to the well one time too many. I mean, this is his fifth, maybe sixth Doctor Who theme that he's come up with, assuming he did the Doctor Who Confidential theme, because I think that was one of his you know, alternate themes that he put to Russell T. Davies that they didn't take, but they put it on Doctor Who Confidential. So we're talking at least five or six different versions of the theme, all of which I've actually liked, but not this one. And at the same time, even listening to it the second time, was there music in this episode? Because I didn't hear any.
I did, but it was very understated. In fact, at one moment when the only moment where I actually remember music, there's a scene where the doctor gets up. The T-Rex is roaring outside. It's night. He's been in the bedroom. He gets up, runs to the door. Door, boring, or whatever.
And love
runs,
that line. That was cool.
That was great. And then he throws open the window and me.
See, that's also reading the script. You're like, yeah, action man.
There's something kind of dashing about it. I mean, it still had this absent-minded craziness about it.
That's the way he played it.
But it makes sense for this, for at least in terms of how the doctor is. And at that moment, I heard some kind of heroic music, which I never heard before. Okay. It was totally new to me, which is why I'm having a hard time remembering anything, because there was just not any of the standard Doctor Who themes that we're familiar with. And I have to wonder, this run in Doctor Who now is kind of going through a really weird change. I mean, a lot of people are referring to this as Doctor 2.0.
Doctor 2.
Yeah, well. Oh.
Who?
And largely because this is the first of the new life cycles.
Hmm.
So, and I remember Moffat stating in interviews that the show was going to go in a really new direction. And granted, I've heard him say that in the past, but this time I think he meant it because it felt very different.
I agree that it did feel different.
And I'm wondering if part of that meant, okay, we're going to throw out every Doctor Who theme we've ever had.
He did it with Matt Smith.
Yeah. Well, but still, sometimes I thought I kept hearing shades of Tennant.
Well, maybe it was just understated to let the story itself and, you know, the regeneration kind of take place.
Maybe, but at the same time, however, there was some very big sweeping. There's a couple of really good action moments, like when Peter steals the horse, and then you've got Strax, Vastra, Jenny, and Clara riding along to get to the Thames as well. I mean, that had a nice little action pace to it, and yet I don't recall. I mean, that if there was supposed to be, if there should have been any kind of good, fun, almost swashbuckling music, it would have been there. And I don't remember it. I'm sure it was there because it probably would have sounded very strange to not have it, but I just don't remember it.
It may have been lower in the mix than they normally do. I mean, how many shows have we seen where the music is just way too high in the mix?
That's true.
Okay. Oh, yeah. One last thing about the music, for me anyway. I did a very unscientific poll. That unscientific poll is...
You asked your kids and your wife.
No, I went to Twitter.
Oh, dear God.
And I searched for the words who and theme for tweets that occurred after the opening thing. And I took sequentially from the moment that I did the search backwards 100 tweets that mentioned the new theme song. And I can tell you,
willing to bet it was largely negative.
Would you like to take a number on that? Out of 100 tweets, how many actively stated they disliked the? And I ignored ones that were neutral. So there were a couple where somebody would say, "And there's new credits and a new theme song. It's Capaldi Day." It's like that's neither positive or negative. So I ignore that. But so they said,
"I
love it."
Did you throw those out, or did you?
I just ignored them. I didn't count them. They weren't. Oh,
you didn't. They're not part of the 100.
They're not. It's either you had to express an opinion that you liked it or you disliked it.
So it's 100.
Yay or nays?
Yays or nays?
I'm going to say 92 nays.
I was going to say 92 as well.
94.
Oh, wow. 94 nays. Good.
94 nays, and many of which were very, very nay. and I didn't count mine. you mentioned the credits. I'm just going to say, I don't know.
What, you didn't like the graphics?
I thought that when that guy came out and did the graphics online, I remember when I posted it because I saw it. And I'm like, you know, that's technically very good. I'll agree. The guy did a technically lovely job. I don't like the clock metaphor, the grinding gears of eternity and the Roman numerals and stuff. And when he did that, I said, you know, it's technically very good, but God, it's crap. And
really,
the
I
fact
rather
that
liked
they took
it.
That and, and decided they wanted to use it. And then they put the part that I hate from the old credits, which is the TARDIS coming at you, doing the sort of slow pivot and then back down. It's like, wow, did you just make the credits I don't like? I honestly was going, where is Sylvester McCoy when I needed him for the music and the credits? Oh, my God.
Yikes. You hated it that much?
I did not like them. Wow. do not like them, I will say. Holy cow. I think if it's, you know, an 18-year-old with his computer at home, it's an impressive job. And if you're a professional person that's doing opening titles to a show, it isn't. So
maybe it's because I'm viewing this as I said, to me, this episode, except for the fact that we've got some carryovers from last year, this really, really, technically, this is a Doctor Who reboot, if you think about it. At least in my mind, I view it as a reboot because of everything that happened in the Christmas special. And given when I approach it from that point of view, I have no problem with these opening credits because it's like this is a brand new show.
Yeah, I just would have been happier with something else. You know it's that.
There's no right or wrong about it. I mean, you didn't like it. You didn't like it. I mean, Keith and I enjoyed it. I mean, we hated the music.
Probably the 50,000th time I hear the music, I'll start to, you know, it'll be in the repertoire with the rest of them.
It'll be less painful.
Exactly. Right. And that's kind of the way I felt about all the previous incarnations of the new series.
I do catch.
Like, oh, crime.
I do catch myself. Even now, when listening to the Doctor Who theme, I occasionally go, da na 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 na, which is from the McCoy theme.
Ugh.
There's that little refrain that they throw in there every once in a while, and I catch myself doing it. It doesn't matter which version of the Doctor Who theme. It's almost like a I can't think of the word now. You would know it. You're the musician person.
Like a coda or what?
Yeah, I can't think of the word. An alternate theme that runs alongside.
Oh, like a counterpoint.
Yes.
A cadence.
Yes. Let's talk about, I don't know. How about Peter Capaldi?
I liked him.
Well, I think we covered a number of things. I thought his post-regenerative madness. Well, if we're going to talk about strictly his acting.
Anything. His character, as it's played.
I enjoyed him enormously. He is a real nutcase. And I base that on other shows that I've watched with him in.
Mm-hmm.
Now I can't judge him based on his one appearance in Fires of Pompeii, but I've seen other, you know, contemporary based dramas where the man is just nuts. You know, and
that's, he's got energy.
He has a lot of energy, which is unusual because he is at this present time the oldest actor to ever play the part. Now I don't know if we want to count John Hurt. I have no idea how old John Hurt was when he played the War Doctor. But if we want to talk about regular actors who've had the role, Peter Capaldi beats William Hartnell by a number of months. That much I know. So he comes into this with more energy than I've seen in a long time. And his lunacy really worked, I thought, as far as the post-regeneration madness. It kind of fit. Given what we know about the we all kind of went into this expecting this regeneration to be really weird. I mean, we all expected it based on what we saw in the Christmas special. So there's nothing new. And then what I also liked how he was able to kind of present this sense of one thing that I really hate in a lot of post-regeneration episodes is that the Doctor just takes far too long to hit the ground running.
Mm-hmm.
It drives me crazy. And we didn't get that. Not from him. There were moments where I could see him phasing into becoming the Doctor and yet still maintain this sense of lack of control. And I really – it's not just in the story, but the way he presented it, the way he acted it, it made his Doctor very interesting to watch because I find most regeneration episodes boring as heck. Hmm. And they drive me mentally. They're just really dull. And largely it's because I want to watch the Doctor. I did not get that this time. I got this sense of this man who was growing into becoming, you know, this Time Lord. And I found him very engaging. And by the time we got to the end of the story, I really, really liked him a lot.
And he thinks the TARDIS should have more round things, which is good.
I loved it.
I have that on my list. Round things.
Yes. And I don't know where I put the round things.
I wonder where I put those.
You know, I couple things I'm just going to mention on him that I thought, because I also enjoyed him. And I already said I think he was doing a little bit of Matt Smith there. I think it's interesting that he drinks, which is not a problem.
No, yeah, it doesn't bother me.
It doesn't bother at all, but he actually looks more like...
You know,
I can picture Pertwee with some wine and some cheese, and whereas Matt Smith would drink that and spit it back in the cup, because that's what Matt Smith did as the Doctor. So I thought that was an interesting change in the personality of the Doctor. I really appreciated that he tried to talk the villain, even to the last, to the brink, on the at the door to where they could both fall and die, that his job there was to talk him into doing the right thing.
Right.
And not forcing him. And of course, they did leave it open as to whether or not he pushed him or not. Mm. But in the script, it's more ambiguous. And I think on the show, it was more obvious that he jumped.
Oh, really?
That's what I thought.
That's not what I thought.
So that's interesting. Because I felt in the script, I was like, I read it, and I was like, yeah, I think they're trying to make it a mystery here. Will this doctor push somebody out the door? And the way the doctor's written, yep, I think he would. But the way he played him, I'm not sure he would.
Oh, I got something entirely different out of that. What do you get, Keith?
I'm kind of a little perplexed about what really happened, but it was the look after that kind of said, oh, okay.
Well, there were two things. The first being was the doctor looks at him, you know, first the droid says, it is against my basic programming to destroy myself, or something to that effect. And the doctor says, murder is against my basic programming. And we know that we know that's not true. He has killed. We've known that.
Well, he's killed, but I don't know that he'd call it murder.
I don't know. I think if we want to look at the entire Doctor Who canon and then take a quick little peek at the two doctors, there was something a bit harsh. Yes, he was being chased by...
Andragum, yeah.
The one Andragum.
Shock Eye,
exactly. But there was something
The Hungerman.
Yeah, the Hungerman. There was something rather pretty harsh about the way he did him in.
That's true.
Made me think...
And he got into a lot of trouble for that, too.
I'm sure he did. But at the same time, the doctor always lies. We know that. And he even says, one of us is lying about our basic programming, and you know who it is, don't you? Or we both know who that is, don't we?
I hate this modern, the doctor always lies.
I'm not a fan of it either, but it's there.
It's there, and it's not consistent throughout. I mean, not saying that the doctor is, you know, a Vulcan and can't tell a lie,
but it's
not this whole, I mean, he's just constantly lying.
It makes him out to be amoral. Which I admit, I agree with you. I don't like it. I mean, the idea that he always lies, I mean, it kind of gives this whole idea that the ends justify the means as far as the doctor's concerned. I mean, it's almost implied there, and I don't care for that. I'd like to think that my doctor is a little bit more upstanding than that. I don't want to call him pious, but he has a bit more, with a bit more virtue.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that he is capable of always lying like that is a bit disturbing. But, you know, but as far as did he push Droid Man out of the door, I kind of think he did, only because he had no choice.
But Droid Man did stop his flames. They backed away. He turned off his fire instrument. I mean, that's true.
That is true. But I kind of also think about, you know, and we commented on this the second time we saw the episode, where the doctor then does this look into the camera. And that was meant for us, the viewer.
I'm sure we'll see that scene when they replay it at the end of the year, when we meet in heaven with them.
If it goes that long.
The other good thing I'll say about Peter Capaldi is his doctor doesn't like karaoke or mime, which is a wonderful. That's enough reason to love him. Right there.
Yeah.
Well, and it appears that he does love scotch too. So
yeah,
well, he's Scottish, so he's got to like the scotch.
Hey, you know,
that's a bit of a cliche.
I thought that was kind of interesting how they really played nationality
into
this.
I mean, Sylvester McCoy was Scottish.
I know. And so is Dave Tennant.
Now.
So is David Tennant.
Right.
And yet they've always done this, especially with Tennant, they've always done this English thing. In fact, earlier today, we just, or at least I watched Dreamland, the animated episode. Oh, right.
I'm so sorry. Yeah.
Well, that's there. Mm. And I was just doing it to kill time. And when he first appears, there's this whole thing, oh, you're English or something like that. And he says, something like that. Yeah, that's me. But there was still that implication of him being English. Well, and it's always kind of been there. We even got that in the Paul McGann. Now, with this... This is the first time where we've actually seen a deliberate departure.
But Eccleston was close. I mean, you're from the north. I mean, the north is about on the border of Scotland. So, I mean, there is something to his accent that is manifesting itself in the way his regenerations play out. But in the past, I mean, that was all they ever got. You're from the north, and then pretty much they dropped it. That's just the way he talks. So yeah, it was very much played up in this one, and I think that's strictly and 100% because Stephen Moffat is Scottish.
Yeah,
and he's just playing with some. I mean, he was doing that with Amy Pond, and I guess we could argue that he picked Scottish because Amy was Scottish.
Possibly, yeah.
Just the same reason that Tennant picked Cockney because Rose was a Cockney. Well, not a Cockney, but a commoner. So.
Maybe.
Two things about the regeneration. What they've played with the Doctor's feelings about regeneration in the past. For example, Tennant gives that heartfelt speech to Wilf about how he doesn't want to die. It's like dying. It's like dying. You end up dead. Then another guy picks up and walks off. This is the first time we've seen it from the other end of the regeneration, where it's like, I'm afraid that everyone I know won't be my friend anymore, won't like me, won't recognize me, won't see me, see something else. Did that play well with you?
No.
Keith?
Well, I...
since Ben's already given us his opinion, I don't know, he's going straight for it.
That whole thing, there were so many different things in the episode talking about that and talking about, you know, who is the Doctor and can we see the Doctor? Can we know who the Doctor is? That whole thing with Vastra and the veil and all that. I tend to think that this is a commentary on the series itself. And it's a commentary on, okay, we have a new Doctor. We need to pick up and let's move on. You know, yes, you have your favorite doctors, but it's a new doctor now. Let's get with the program and move on. I mean, that's kind of what...
It was for my daughter.
Yeah.
You know, and Keith just reminded me of something just now when he said that. We remember when it was announced that Matt Smith was leaving. And of course, there was all this huge speculation as to who was going to become the new doctor. And the two big things that people were talking about is they wanted different skin color or different gender. And you and I have had that conversation in the past. And of course, they all base that largely around the Doctor's wife, where the Doctor admits that Time Lords can change their gender through regeneration.
Well, the Doctor always lies.
That's true. The Doctor always lies.
So nothing you say can be taken as canon because of the Doctor always lies.
It seems
like a gimmick to me, and that's really the big...
I know.
That's the big deal. But
the fact remains is that there was a lot of there was huge public outcry about getting
a woman.
It was really noisy. Whether it was huge is another matter. Well, I think it was pretty big. From where I was sitting,
small mouse can squeak pretty loud on the internet.
I know, but Keith and I, you know, at that time we were very much involved with Slice of Sci-Fi, and there was just we were hearing it a lot over there. A lot of people saying it really, you know, make it a woman. And you and I have had that conversation. We were both in opposition to the idea of you just don't regenerate the Doctor into a woman just to satisfy the fans, because that's pandering. And you don't want to do that. I mean, you do it if it makes sense, if it's organic to the story. Just don't do it because people want you to do it.
That's the problem. It's not organic to the story. Yeah.
Well, no. Well, certainly at this point it hasn't been.
But now somehow the Scotsman is. Is that worse?
Well... To some people, it was. And not the fact that he's Scottish, but the fact that it was an older guy. Now, yeah,
exactly. And that's what I had talked about as well. We talked about that after the second episode, or while the second episode, or second
time. Second airing.
Second airing, yes. I felt that they thought they needed to make the Doctor younger, and then because people have difficulty with the regeneration anyway, And then all of a sudden here, they're bringing somebody in that's much older, and we have that whole thing.
Well, you know. We all saw what Matt Smith looked like when he regenerated. He looked 2,000 years old, so he is much younger this time through.
Well, that is true. But in terms of first-time regeneration episodes, he was significantly older than we've seen David Tennant or Matt Smith. And we saw the progression. I mean, I kept thinking, holy cow, if they keep going down this road, I mean, next thing you know, you're going to get Justin Bieber to be playing the Doctor. And then I'd have to kill myself. So I think a lot of people were kind of outraged.
I think Keith's right. I think he's dead right. I think
I do too.
The phone call from Matt Smith to Clara in this episode, which I didn't care for, was written for
the fans.
It was written for my daughter.
Absolutely.
It was absolutely written for girls who, you know, might have a little crush on the pretty boy along the way and say, look, I am, you know, this is the way it is. Bear with me. You'll see I'm the same man. I need your help. Da, da, right. Da. It was like he was looking at the screen right at her.
Yeah, I agree. I think Keith nailed it when he said that it was a commentary. I think he's absolutely right.
Yeah. And then to kind of continue on in that vein, that whole episode with Vastra and the Veil, and I think that whole episode was don't judge a book by its cover, because Clara seemed to say at the very beginning of the episode, this is the Doctor. Mm-hmm. I saw him change, and then all of a sudden
she's like, doctor back.
She has a problem with him.
Yeah, she kept saying, I want my doctor back.
Okay.
And so then was, you know, where you need to look at the heart, and that's where Vastra's comments came
in. So this is my main complaint about this. I don't have any problem with this storyline where the companion has to adapt to the doctor in various, and we can explore that in different ways.
I know where you're going with this.
Right. With Rose, it was, you know, he left me, and et cetera. But in the case of Clara, of all the companions
she's
the wrong one for this storyline, because she, of all people, has seen one of them.
That's right. And she's the impossible girl. She has, according to that story, she has actually been there to try to help each incarnation of the Doctor. Given that, she is the last person to be judging him.
Right. She's seen every incarnation of the Doctor. She knows that he's the same man in different guise. And
fell in love with him.
I think she did.
I think there's a little something there, and I'm glad they didn't go the route with Rose and all the weepy and the mascara running. And, he left me, Mom, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, she of all companions should be more accepting than any other companion that's ever existed. If anyone in this universe should be able to have no problem with him regenerating, it's Clara.
Well, they kind to play that on the flip side, there is this one bit where Vastra does tell Clara that the Doctor trusts her more than anyone and needs her more than anyone else. Vastra already has that understanding because she was there on Trenzalore when the crypt was open. So she understands Clara's role in all of this, on some level at least. So for her, it makes perfect sense for her to deliver that line. She shouldn't have had to.
Right.
But I kind of understand why Vastra had to kind of like hammer it in. You know, Clara, of all people, you should get this.
Well, it goes back to what is the purpose of this whole story. The purpose of this whole story is a regeneration episode and saying, okay, people, this is what it is. Let's, you know, accept this doctor and let's move on.
So they have to use Clara as the person, because she's the companion. She's the continuing factor. So they have to write her character that way. I agree, she's the wrong person, but then at the on the other side, who else do you use?
Yeah. I mean, they don't have anyone else.
No, you can't use the Paternoster gang.
Right.
You can't use them because they're not, I mean, even though they've
Amy would have been the perfect one.
Yeah, actually Amy would have been.
That would have been the perfect Amy story, but they didn't get that. Well, what about the notion that, the Doctor's face is trying to tell him something? Why did he pick this face? Why is it that one? And also the notion that the faces he had chosen before were flirty faces. I mean, I like the idea that this face is not a flirty face, therefore we can dispense with all that flirty crap that we've had for the last...
Well, I'm done with that.
X number of years, I'm totally done with that. And obviously, this is the way of trying to describe why he was in Fires of Pompeii, and now he's got that face.
That's what I chalked it up to.
Well, that part, I'm sure there's something to that. But the way he said, what is this face trying? It's trying to tell me something. What is it trying to tell me? What, you know, there's probably going to be a line somewhere along the line that's like, oh, I better be a better father or some silly thing.
I do know that when it was announced that Peter Capaldi was going to be the Doctor, there were a number of people, and it really kind of pissed me off, to be honest. There were a number of people that kind of said, well, but he played Salius in Fires of Pompeii. How are they going to explain the fact that he's got this new face? And I turned to these people and I said, don't. You know, it's happened before. No, it hasn't. Yes, it has. Colin Baker.
Exactly.
Maxell. He was Maxell in Arc of Infinity. The idea of recirculating cast members into new roles is nothing new. Personally, I would have liked it if they had just left it alone.
Yeah, I don't have any problem with the notion that the Doctor, you know, randomly picks faces and, you know, it's just one he's seen somewhere down the line. And, you know, of the thousands and thousands of faces he's seen, sometimes you get it. You can just say, oh, well, you know, that's the way it is. We don't have to have a reason.
No.
It doesn't have to be, oh, you know, it's telling me something. It's like, no,
but because of that, of the big response, oh my gosh, but he was also in Fires of Pompeii. How are you going to explain that, huh? Well, Moffat then came out and said, there's going to be an explanation. There is a reason why he has the face of Salius.
Yeah.
It's going to be explained. And personally, I'm like,
I'm not
going to
like that.
I'm not really keen on that. At the same time, however, I am very curious to see how they're going to deliver on that one.
Hit me on a couple things here. The dinosaur. Big Ben's 96 meters high.
That dinosaur is huge.
And that doesn't come across in the script, that the dinosaur is Godzilla-sized.
I know. We're talking latest Godzilla-sized, too.
We're not, actually. We're talking about Godzilla size from between Godzilla versus King Ghidorah when he was recreated by the Russian atomic weapon and destroyed.
Oh, that era.
Yeah.
Oh, that era.
That
era. He was still pretty big.
He was about 100 meters there. Then he went to about 130 in the Millennium series. So, yeah, he's about 100 meters.
Well,
that's about as nerdy as this podcast is ever going to get.
No,
it was forced perspective. My gosh.
Yeah. I wonder, why did they do it, though? In other words,
there's something very strange about that. It really caused me to scratch my head. There's that one scene. You know, you've got you have the gang. They're right there on the bridge. They're looking at the dinosaur, and of course, Jenny has to make the comment. She says, "But I've seen them.
Uh-huh.
They're not that big. I know the physical evidence. You know, I've seen fossils in museums. They're not that big." And Vastra does what I call a hand wave by simply saying, "I've seen them personally."
And so they had to get a dinosaur apparently big enough to swallow the TARDIS, which is about, I guess, what they had to get to this point.
So that was the only reason they made the
T-Rex
that
maybe
huge.
It looks cool walking next to Big Ben. That's why Godzilla's the size he is. They picked the size of Godzilla so that he would tower next to the buildings.
Even though it's biologically
utterly
impossible.
Biologically impossible, yeah, that's in the way. A T-Rex would be approximately 5 meters tall,
yeah.
Not 100 meters. So that's off by a factor of 20 to 25.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, a little bit wrong. So
it's significant. Now, having said that, I mean, we all agree that the size of the T-Rex was way off. I thought it was cool that he was there.
It was cool.
I really dig it.
And I felt sorry for it.
I did too.
Yeah,
so that kind of dovetails into this next little bit, something that Keith and I both noticed. We caught it the first time, but we really caught it the second time. And that was the Doctor translating the T-Rex? When he was unconscious?
Partially.
Or was he talking to Clara?
Both.
I say both, yeah.
He was translating at first, saying the sky and everything's different. And then at the end, Clara thought he was still translating the T-Rex, but he was saying, you can't see me,
you can't see
my face. That's
That was for
he
her.
He shifted. Yeah, he was talking to her.
It goes back to the commentary on the series.
Yeah. But one of the things that I... Because we were hearing that translation in the beginning, and I did agree that the first part of it did sound like it was about the T-Rex. When the T-Rex spontaneously combusted, I was really bummed out. That really made me sad. Yeah, it didn't anger me, because I want to harken back to 2 years ago with Dinosaurs on a Spaceship, which I hated beyond belief. And Keith and I, we were in Canada when that episode aired.
That's probably why you didn't like it.
No. Yeah. Yeah. It was the Vancouver television. When the Triceratops gets killed, it felt, I was angry because it felt like it had no purpose.
Yeah.
It felt really meaningless.
It was gratuitous.
It was. It really bothered me in that respect.
It made you want the doctor to kill that guy at the end of the episode.
It didn't work for me. It just didn't gel. It felt very, again, Keith used the right word, it felt very gratuitous. It did not, I don't like the idea of revenge in that sort of way. And to try to generate a feeling of revenge or a sense of vengeance. How dare you kill this dinosaur? Now you must die. I mean, to me, that's really just kind of ugly. And I don't like that. In this particular case, however, there was a purpose behind it. I may not have liked it, but there was supposedly some purpose, how there were things in the dinosaur physiology which could be harvested. It tragic? Heck yeah.
It was still
an integral part of the story.
I felt sorry for the dinosaur, and I also felt sorry for the doctor because he was in the midst of saying,
I will save you.
I will take care of you.
Exactly. However, there's this incredible tragedy about it now.
That's another thing about this series itself is the doctor always says, I will protect you. And, you know, how many times
has companions
have we seen, and how many people have we seen that he has failed to protect?
And the dinosaur's yet another one.
So here's the continuity flaw then. Why did the robots spontaneously combust the people?
To hide the bodies that had missing parts.
They spontaneously combusted the dinosaur before they harvested its eyes, which is what it said had the element.
That's true.
Yeah.
So it was gratuitous, and then they came up with an excuse out of the past fact.
I hate it. See, now I hate it. I'm angry.
That's not the only continuity flaw in this episode.
Well, there's no tree when he gets the horse. He's hanging from a tree in front of a horse, and when he gets on the horse, there's no tree. Nowhere near.
Or there's the bucket of water that Strax puts on the table, and then it's no longer there, so, yeah.
Yeah, that disappeared. And also, I hated the sound effect when the doctor fell asleep. When she put him out, he kind of goes, boing,
oh,
and he's
that.
Out.
It was very Looney Tunes. I mean, yeah, it was like something out of a cartoon. To be funny, you know, I actually didn't notice that the first time. I caught it the second.
Yeah, it was like, oh, you know, I don't like the funny part. I mean, I like the doctor being witty. I don't like the doctor being zany. I mean, and that goes with the show, too. I just, you know, you don't need a sound effect. If he goes to Australia, I don't want to see the kangaroos go boing, boing.
I know.
And I love that. And one of my favorite movies, Reckless Kelly, they do that, but it would not be appropriate in Doctor Who.
It was comical.
There was trivia for our non-British audience. Blue Peter, longtime TV show, had a contest for children to design 3 sonic devices for Vastra, Jenny, and Strax, and the winners got their props made, and they were in this episode. Strax's medical analyzer device was a contest winner. Jenny's armband scanner was a device that was designed by a kid, and Vastra's completely stupid and irritating hat pin that locked the door was.
Yeah.
Apparently they couldn't come up with anything for it to do. So they made it that door.
Yeah, it locked the car.
I didn't like that. I just mentioned congratulations to the kids, though. Awesome for you.
Awesome for you.
And a Blue
Eugene
Peter
hated them.
No, I didn't mind them.
You just hated Vastra's.
The hat pin was silly. I thought, what are they going to do with it? And then, you know, it's like when David Tennant chirped the TARDIS door. Yeah, that joke just doesn't. That 40 years from now, that joke's going to fall
flat. It's not going to hold up, no.
It's not going to hold up, nobody think. Gruesome body parts.
Yeah.
Balloon made out of skin. Sticking the human face on Clara's face.
Oh, that was a little creepy.
It was weird.
The doctor wearing a human face.
Yeah, the whole middle of this episode just lost me. I thought it was it was almost a non sequitur.
The clockwork droids, you know, okay, fine. Do we really need a sequel?
But from the 51st century. I mean, now there's a whole story element that I'm really stopping.
Yeah, it got interesting by the time it was all over.
Yeah, well, the 51st century was where the Madame de Pompadour was from Girl in the Fireplace.
Right.
And it could travel in time. That's how they were going back to going through the life of Madame de Pompadour. So it obviously had some sort of temporal travel. And conveniently, inside small parts on the spaceship, not only do they include the name of the Marie Antoinette, but then in smaller print, it says sister ship to the Madame de Pompadour.
True,
right.
Which is ridiculous. I'm sure the Titanic did not have on all its parts sister ship to the Britannic. That was just... And then the Doctor doesn't recognize it. So as sequels go, it's not even really a sequel.
No.
It's just, you know, they don't even look the same.
No, and I have a problem with these very clockwork type mechanoids from the 51st century. I mean, to me, that just seems really out of date.
Well, it's steampunk.
Yeah.
So I had a problem with that. And that's why I kept thinking, is there another connection that we are missing at this point or has not been introduced to us?
I just think that when they made the first episode, I think the clockwork creatures in the, 17th century? 18th century. Probably 18th century.
And it's Victorian England.
No. I mean in Girl in the Fireplace.
Oh.
That's earlier. I think that's 18th century.
Yeah, that's earlier. Yeah.
I think that makes it look like they're part of that period. And so it made it a creepy and kind of cool thing. And then when they take you back to the 51st century, you're supposed to not think about that too much. So they're supposed to look like they belong in the 18th century, 17th century, whatever century it is.
Okay.
And then, because it that does look cool in the Regency and the clockworks, and you go, wow, yeah, if they were making a robot back then, that's how they would do it. But then they kind of, you wave your hands and forget about it when they go to the 51st century, or you should. But now that they've decided to bring them back, it's more obvious that that's silly.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought it was weird.
And then they made them so unrecognizable that why even bother to bring them back?
Yeah. Well, the only one that was recognizable was Mr. Half-Face himself.
And that's just barely. I mean, with the Roman caging around the face and all the stuff it was. Oh, and also gruesome body on the spire.
Yeah.
That was a bit. Yeah. Luckily, it was kind of far away, but yeah, it was pretty gnarly.
So that was, I wanted to mention those.
One thing that kind of really made me just stop and say, huh, is the Doctor's been alive for over 2,000 years. Do we really want to do the math on this one?
Well, I think that's right. I think he was 600 to 800 years on Trenzalore. He was 300 years to the point where he was limping. He said that much.
Yeah.
So, and then a whole bunch more years before Clara came back again at the end. So, 2,000 years, considering he was already going in 1,400 years old, I don't like that they did that to him. I like the fact that the Doctor got a long run on one of his bodies. I've always disliked the fact that poor, you know.
He always has to regenerate early.
You know, you kind of look at Tom Baker and you think, he lived 7 years. You know, there's this sort of one-to-one relation between the two because you see that steady progression with the companions. And so there's really no time for him to go off for 800 or 900 years and then come back and pick up another companion.
Right. Well, I found a graphic online.
Today. Oh, yeah. I've seen that one.
The Age of the Doctor?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it shows that there's clearly been some very bizarre reset because according to this, Paul McGann's Doctor was 1,125 years old, but then when we get to David Tennant, he's only 903.
Right. They've totally messed it. But in Modern Who, we started at 901 for Eccleston, I think he said in Aliens of London.
Well, you know, it's all wibbly wobbly, timey wimey,
and the Doctor lies.
And the Doctor,
and
lies.
It's even stated that actually Moffat himself said, and I have this quote. It was from SFX in 2010. The thing that I keep banging on about is that he doesn't know what age he is. He's lying. How could he know unless he's marking it on a wall? He could be 8,000 years old. He could be a million. He has no clue. The calendar will give him no clues. Thank you, Grand Moff.
Got a point there, but I think the TARDIS probably knows what its own relative time is.
I would think.
Although, on the other hand, then the TARDIS was not with him for hundreds of years on Trenzalore, so...
No, that's true.
So they're off. We could talk about Clara, but Clara is Clara. I mean, I like that she's an egomaniac, needy game player, and says, nothing's more important than my egomania. That was a good line.
Well, yeah, but I felt that entire scene in the restaurant. I mean, we're presented immediately with this interesting little mystery. Who posted the ad? But then we have to have this bickering.
Mm-hmm.
In any other situation, in any other part of the story, I might have found it enjoyable, but not at that moment. It actually took me out of the tension that was starting to be built up. So I did not care for it at that moment. It would have worked much better, say, a little earlier or a little later.
I thought it was a good scene between them. I thought the dynamic was working on them.
Well, it is a good scene if it were completely isolated. But in the context of what's happening, I did not like it. Not there.
Okay, so not that I have ever in the past suggested that we hurry up a podcast, so I'm not going to do that. Keith's got a list.
Oh,
so what have you got that we haven't talked about?
Well, there was just one thing that I have on my list that is kind of, it just says Strax.
I do have a Strax section in there, but I didn't.
That's all that needs to be said, is just Strax and Strax.
I do not like the comedy Santarin approach, but with Strax and the way they've now got the character, I've gotten to the point where I kind of like him. He has the funniest lines.
Yeah.
Enviable spleen. Well done.
Yeah. The only other thing that we really haven't talked about is I like the new costume. And
I love the new costume.
I think it's interesting, but I feel that it probably is going to evolve and it will be more interesting to see where it evolves. Mm. And then the last thing is the woman.
Yes, this woman who says the doctor is her boyfriend. Who, and this has to be considered along with the little question that the doctor asks Clara towards the end of the episode, and that was, who gave her the number to call him, and who placed that advertisement? There's almost this implication that it was the same person, and that this person wants the two of them together. And if it's this mysterious woman who claims the doctor is her boyfriend, that seems kind of odd. I mean, we were left with a really weird mystery.
We've got the darn story thing going again.
I know. And yeah. Moffat had already said that he wasn't going to go down that road. Yet he's throwing it out here right out of the just right out of the gate. And I mean, I was kind of happy that they
It won't be the last time we see her either.
No, oh, heck no. I already know she's coming back several times.
Are you trying to imply that there's a story arc on this series?
Yeah.
Oh, that's not even implying. He's simply stating there is.
There's one of those story arcs that I'm not going to like.
No, I'm not happy about it. I'm not necessarily happy about it either. But I was kind of pleased that at least they did hearken back to the phone call. From the Bells of St. John.
That one irritated the heck out of me. I'm glad at least something's going to be done with it, even if it's something I'm not going to like.
It bothered me that, I was always irritated that it never got addressed. That's a bad hand wave. At least it felt like that throughout the remaining episodes for that series. And then for it to be brought back in this one. I mean, it was like, yes, I'm so glad they're finally going to tie up this last bloody thread, because it really kind of annoyed me that it had never been talked about.
Okay, so I got my last thing on here on the list, and actually it's really good that we have the two gay geeks on the podcast.
Uh-oh, here it comes.
What the heck is up with those lesbians?
Ah, there, see?
I mean, are they trying to act like the worst stereotypes that we can imagine running around? The whole men are monkeys. I mean, lesbians I know are not men haters. And yet.
Actually, I know a couple that are.
Well, I'm sure that there are. But so that's why it's kind of like, but that does seem to be the stereotype. And Moffat is not known for writing particularly good female characters, and so it's so wrong. I mean, down to the fact that, let's see, Vastra's sitting there and she's getting Clara all ticked off and she says, oh, very interesting. I always wanted to be like when the lake got disturbed or something like that. And Jenny smacks her and says,
when you lose your
temper. Married. It's like, I didn't see anything going on there.
Well, I kind of caught it the second time.
There was a little flirtatious.
There was something there. She says, it's nice to see what you look like when you lose your temper.
And then the next time we see Jenny asking Vastra about spontaneous human combustion, and she says, well, that's when there's a theory that a human body with little, it could explode. And she says, oh, you're flirting. Like, she was flirting.
That was weird.
And there's the scene where she's like, for the outside world, we maintain our pretense that she is my mate. And yet here I am pouring the tea again for you.
I think
you.
That was done purely as a joke. Not a good one.
Is there a divorce coming in reptile and human land here?
I doubt it. No, I don't think so. I think it was done purely as a farce. I don't think there's any significance to it. It was just done as a joke and not a good one, to be honest.
It was just sarcasm, I think.
Well, they didn't back away from it though, because she immediately basically put her down.
Well,
and then she made another couple. So I mean, it's not like a couple
well,
where you.
Vastra's always been she's self-important.
Yes,
and,
precisely.
And superior.
Precisely. That is, I mean, if we are to accept the fact that Vastra is, if not Silurian, she's at least related to the Silurians. I mean, the Silurians from past episodes, we know they've got this superiority complex over apes.
Yes, which and does make that relationship a little lopsided.
What that tells me is that in this particular case, this is less about lesbianism and more about bestiality.
didn't get that one, you just
caused us to have to put
an explicit warning on this
yes,
episode.
Exactly.
Worse than that, once they figure that out on Doctor Who, they won't be able to run it out after 9.
No,
before 9 p.m. watershed, because that's illegal in some parts.
Illegal in a lot of places. Most places where Doctor Who would air, it will be illegal. The relationship,
the flirty bits, I wasn't seeing flirty bits, and the relationship between them is so uneven and so.
It's been uneven
unfair.
Since the very first time we saw them.
Well, yes, but they're making the relationship more. And I want to say explicit. That's not the word I'm going for. But in other words, we're getting more screen time with Vastra and Jenny, and the more screen time we get with Vastra and Jenny, the more we get to explore their relationship, and the more it doesn't make any sense because I just still have. You know, Vastra has this superiority complex over apes. Okay, fine. But you overcome that in love, or it isn't love unless it's a pet.
Well, that's the part that bugs me.
And I
kind of think this is just Vastra falling back possibly on psychological conditioning on her part. But yes, she has overcome that. We know she's overcome that. We saw that on Trenzalore when the Great Intelligence was killing Jenny. We saw how Vastra reacted towards that. And clearly, Jenny reciprocates because she says to Clara in today's episode, I just don't like her. I love her. So I think there's some kind, I don't want to call it compensation or damage control or anything like that. I mean, it's really hard to kind of write that kind of relationship because Jenny gets it right. She's a lizard. So there's going to be some different kind of behavior anyway.
Doesn't answer the question though. What if she changed? What if Vastra changed into a male human?
Well, that's you make a good point because Jenny did. She never did answer that question. She fell back on. I married a lizard.
See, I can take differences. Okay,
but can you handle change?
Can you really?
Can you handle change? That's the question that Clara was asking,
and she didn't answer it.
No.
Well,
I just have...
Well, the whole episode's about change anyway, so...
Yeah. I don't think I've got anything else on this. I think I pretty much covered all of my points.
Then Keith will let you go first for last thoughts.
I thought it was a good episode. It was a little uneven at first, but a very good episode, and I like Peter Capaldi as the Doctor.
Ben?
I found it to be a well-played episode, and not a bad start for Peter Capaldi. I hope we get to see more character growth in him. But right now, he does appear to have a certain weight to the personality, which gives him a sense of gravitas and seriousness. Authoritative has been a word that's been thrown around, which I think is very applicable. In some ways, this does feel like a slight callback to earlier Doctors, most specifically Hartnell and Troughton. But yet at the same time, it feels like a fresh new start. This, as far as regeneration episodes go, I thought it was equally as strong as 11th Hour. Mm. It was big. This episode was action-oriented, and at the same time, it was also heartwarming. It made me think about veils and the masks that we all wear, and how important it is for us to see through them.
Hmm. That's unusually deep. I don't mean that's unusually deep for you. I just mean that's unusually deep for an analysis of a Doctor Who episode, which is usually a pretty light piece of fluff. My thought is I enjoyed it. I'm looking forward to seeing it on the big screen in 2 days, even though I've now seen it twice, and I don't need to see it a third time, but hey, I want to see that dinosaur on a big screen.
And you paid your money.
I want to see the reaction of the other people. That was really I found enjoyable at the 50th at the theater was listening to the other people have the reaction and go through. So I'm enjoying Peter Capaldi so far. He's not quite what I thought he was going to be out of the scripts, which is, I guess, the interpretation of actor to screen, and perhaps director along the way. We'll see how that goes with the next few, and particularly Robots of Sherwood. That will be an interesting test. Mm-hmm. And so I'm cautiously optimistic, whereas previously I was completely gung-ho. So we'll see how that works out. And I am not above shameless plugging, so I'm going to start here by plugging TG Geeks. You call it a webcast, don't you?
Yep.
I suppose so. So that's tggeeks.com. And that is Ben and Keith giving their thoughts on things more current than what we're usually talking about on Fusion Patrol.
Well, except for now.
Yeah.
Now we're pretty... every time Doctor Who season is in season, we are very current.
When the Doctor is in season, that's back to that flirting thing.
so it wasn't meant to be.
And I'm also going to plug myself, because that's what I can do when I'm doing it. That is, in case anyone is interested, my first novella, Spacefall, which is a bit of a science fiction comedy romp, is available for purchase on Amazon on Kindle. That's Spacefall by Eugene Glover.
It's an interesting read.
It is a stunning endorsement. Well, their podcast is an interesting podcast too, folks.
So, well, I'll be the first to admit that.
Anyway, listeners, we hope you'll join us next week when we will be looking into the Dalek on Fusion Patrol.
Cheers.
Peace.
Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us, leave us a review on iTunes, or stop by and visit at our website, fusionpatrol.com. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, search for Fusion Patrol, or just drop us a note at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.
This will be edited out.
Really?
Yeah, think!